Well, you may hear I have a bit of a cold this morning, so, but I think I can think clearly enough this morning. There's a question that I want to put before us. A question each of us will need to answer for ourselves by the end of this morning. The question is, what will I do with Jesus and his Sermon on the Mount, with his words? And I ask this because today we are completing our journey through it. A journey that Pastor Dave started us back in January, and for good reason. I mean, Jesus is the most influential figure in all of history, right? And the core of what Jesus taught, the way of life that he set before us and the way of life that he lived, is found here in what has come to be known as the Sermon on the Mount. Where would we find that? Trivia question. By now you know. What book of the Bible is it in? Matthew, what chapters?
5 to 7.
Thank you. 5 to 7. There we go. Okay. Need a little brush up here. I want you to turn to it, okay? We're going to be reading from there in a moment. But even before we read from the section that we're going to be looking at, the last chapter of that in chapter 7, I want us to look first at chapter 5, right back to the very beginning. You see, Matthew, a disciple of Jesus, he was the one who collected and compiled for us, and he understood that Jesus to be the new Moses. Moses, you know, Charlton Heston played the Moses in the great Ten Commandments, the great figure that brought the Israelites out of Egypt. Well, Matthew, when he introduces Jesus forth in chapter 5, verse 1, he says, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside, and he sat down. I used to think, oh, when he sat down, he was resting. No, in their culture, that would be like he stood up behind the pulpit to preach. That was the posture of teaching posture in that day, was to sit down, and then people would be ready to listen. Matthew expected us to hear echoes of the first great revelation that God had delivered to his people through Moses on Mount Sinai, the giving of the Ten Commandments. Matthew expected us to recall the prophetic promise of a great prophet the Lord would send after Moses to bring the work he had started to its glorious climax and conclusion. That is, having a liberated people in a new life, in a new land of glorious freedom and righteousness. Many of you have probably seen the clip. Martin Luther King, remember when he delivered that great sermon? I've been to the mountaintop, right? I've seen the promised land. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. And that was what Jesus was saying. I have seen it. And he was now sharing it with the people. The great prophet had come, and by the end of the message on the mountain, he has shared with us God's vision, his dream for a better world. He has clarified and unpacked God's will for us, what God's will has always been, though never quite as well understood as before. Jesus said up front in chapter 5, verse 17, do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them, to bring them to completion. This is what life can and will be like when God's will is acted out on earth as it is in heaven. There will be, as we looked at the Sermon on the Mount, faithfulness in marriage. There will be truthfulness in speech. There will be an abolition of hatred and violence and war. People hell-bent on hoarding and stockpiling wealth for themselves will discover the joy of blessing and the blessing of sharing what they have with others. And in so doing, they will make poverty history. Here, in this sermon, Jesus makes plain for us the real good life, the God life that will flourish when we follow him and his lead. Yet in the face of such high ethical ideals, one writer observed, I think what many of us have thought, as soon as we begin to read it, we have an undertone of doubt and fear that it's not workable. We feel that it is trying to give human nature a bent that it will not take. So a good deal of discussion among readers and interpreters throughout the centuries has centered on whether the Sermon on the Mount is an impossible ideal. demanding such a lofty standard that no one can possibly attain it. You know, it's like, perfect people need only apply. You know, you get those resumes sometimes, and you're thinking they're just looking for God, right? And there have been, you know, this is an impossible ethic. Martin Luther was one of many who have said, well, yes, it is, but it was given to convict us that it is impossible. We think that we're able to live the God life. It is impossible. Some dispensationalist thought, well, Jesus is really talking about when the millennium kingdom comes, this is the way life is going to be. But there were others in the Reformation, such as the radical reformers, known as the Anabaptists, who considered the Sermon on the Mount to be an ideal that we are supposed to imitate. Why else, they said, would Jesus say it? Why else would he teach us to pray for God's kingdom to come, for his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven, if he didn't expect it to actually happen? Now, I think there's truth in both interpretations. It is impossible to achieve this on our own, absolutely. But Jesus is also telling us that those who decide to follow him as his disciples, his apprentices, will find themselves undergoing such a radical reformation and life-changing transformation that they will begin to learn to think and act like Jesus. The kingdom will come. Come follow me, he said, and I will make you into new creatures, new creations, part of the new creation. Let's read the closing of Matthew chapter 7, 13 to 29. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. I mean, do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. You know, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons and in your name perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. Oh, the rain came down, the streams rose, and the wind blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. By now, Jesus has spelled out in detail what God's kingdom is like, what entering into this way of life will cost, and what to expect if we follow him. He tells us right up front at the moment of decision that the gate of entry into this way is narrow. It is so narrow that it only takes one person at a time. And every person who goes through that doorway can only fit through by giving up everything that they have. We see that over and over again in the Gospels. It means letting go of what we're used to clinging to. You know, it could be our career path. I remember having to give that up as a young adult. Or our reputation, or our status, or our pride. I think of Nicodemus in John 3. Or we cling to our indulgences and our addictions, our earthly treasures. We hang on to a hatred. We keep nursing a grudge. Or just that need to be in control. This is a road less traveled, not only because it is narrow at the beginning, notice, at the gate is narrow, but it continues to be narrow the rest of the way, the narrow road. For many people, this sounds very narrow-minded. And we don't want to be considered narrow-minded in our culture, do we? I don't. After all, the Canadian way is to keep our options open, to believe that all spiritual paths lead to the same destination, or to believe and teach that one's biology, that is, being born male or female, has little, if anything, to say about one's sexual orientation or gender identity currently being rolled out in our public schools. Disagree with this open-minded opinion, and you are sure to be labeled and heckled as someone hopelessly intolerant, narrow-minded, and bigoted. Now, I should say that people who experience the often socially crippling condition of gender dysphoria need our compassion. And gender dysphoria, when people experience an incongruence between their biological sex and their psychological and emotional experience of gender. What we would often say, feels like a man trapped in a woman's body or like a woman trapped in a man's body. But as Dr. Paul McHugh, former psychiatrist in chief at John Hopkins Hospital, stated in his controversial Wall Street Journal op-ed, policymakers and media are doing no favors either to the public or the transgendered by treating their confusions as a right in need of defending rather than as a mental disorder that deserves understanding, treatment, and prevention. Like other disorders of assumption, and he lists, for example, anorexia and bulimia nervosa, where the assumption that departs from the physical reality is the belief by the dangerously thin that they are massively overweight, and so they starve themselves. It's a disorder of assumption. Now, I'm giving as an example of a current hot-button issue where people who go against the flow of political correctness are sure to get a feel for the narrow way that Jesus said his followers should expect to experience. Jesus is clear that his way is difficult. But that is because it is the only choice, he says, that leads to life. And when we think about it, the best choices and best results in life usually require great personal investment and self-discipline. I can tell you that no athlete makes it into the professional ranks or into the Olympics without having had to say no to a lot of things. I know our son, trying to be a professional musician, says no to a lot of things. And he practices a lot of times when there's a lot of other fun things to do. And Jesus has been telling us about healthy relationships. And he says that will require dealing with the roots of anger. He'll say, marital faithfulness, that is great. But you achieve it by practicing visual purity. Verbal integrity comes by making honesty the only policy. Violence and hatred and bitterness and war are avoided when we learn to not retaliate and actively work at loving our enemies. These are difficult, but the rewards, Jesus is saying, are great. Jesus immediately moves from his challenge of the narrow road in verses 13 and 14 to those who will help or hinder us on the way, the true and false prophets. Given the number of references to false teachers that we find in the letters in the New Testament, Jesus' warning against false prophets was and obviously is an important one. There have been many false prophets throughout Israel's history, people who claimed to speak the truth, but Jeremiah put it, they said, they dress the wounds of my people as though they were not serious. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace. In other words, one of the marks of false prophets was they played down the seriousness of people's sin and its consequences. Both then and now, false prophets, false teachers make their livelihood by being politically correct, avoiding anything that will make them sound intolerant. First, 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul will speak to Timothy and he says, watch out, people will just tell people whatever, you know, their itching ears want to hear. Right? They speak boldly about the love and mercy of God, which is true, but downplaying or avoiding the topic of God's wrath and judgment. I mean, I can think of it, It's like if my doctor, if my my brother, when he went to the doctor and the test results were bad, I can imagine the doctor saying, oh, this is going to make him feel really bad. I'll tell him it's really not that bad. It's a bad cold. It's not really cancer. Jesus gives the hard truth because he knows in the long run, that's what we need to hear. Otherwise, we give people a false sense of security. We get lulled to sleep in our sins and waywardness. But Jesus warns us. He warns us when we're hell-bent. And he points us back to the narrow way. So beware, Jesus says. He warns, for the gate we enter and the road we travel, the voices we listen to and the people that we follow, that has lasting consequences. So choose wisely. How then do we recognize the true guides from the false ones and the true disciples from the false ones? Well, twice in verse 16 and again in verse 20, Jesus underlines the discerning principle. By their fruit, you will recognize them. Look beneath the surface. What is the fruit of their life like? What are those who follow them and hang around them? What are they like? Do they strain what they say through their own experience as their integrity? Or are they double-minded? Now, I don't think Jesus is saying that we should be looking for perfect people. None of his disciples were. But he is saying that we should be looking, I think, for genuinely good people. People whose character, you know, you really wish would rub off on you. Right? I think in the statement in Acts chapter 4, verse 13, the Pharisees and leaders, they see Jesus' disciples. They see they're acting just as rebellious, you know, as Jesus was in terms of just speaking the truth when it wasn't politically correct. And it says they took note that these men had been with Jesus. Chip off the old block, we would say. Well, in verses 21 to 27, Jesus takes final steps to do what he can to ensure a proper response to the message. He warns us of two unacceptable alternatives. First, in verses 21 to 23, that of mere lip service. And secondly, in the parable of the two builders, warning us against merely intellectual assent. You see, the only thing worse than being deceived by others is being deceived by ourselves. There are people, Jesus says, who may have grown up knowing how to talk the language of faith and have deceived themselves into thinking that they have faith. I think of an Elvis impersonator. You know, he's gotten so used to doing his shtick the whole time that he comes to believe that he really is Elvis.
Right? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Right? If you say it often enough, no. Never forget, several years ago, I was doing rounds in a hospital as volunteer chaplain. And I came and I met this amazing elderly lady. And I say elderly because she was like in her 90s. And in the course of our conversation, she talked about how over the years she had spent a lot of time in church and been around Christian people, and she just assumed, therefore, that she was a Christian. And then one day, someone she had known for quite a while asked her more pointed questions about her personal relationship with Jesus. And in the course of that conversation, she began to realize that she knew quite a bit about Jesus, but she didn't actually know Jesus personally and talk with him. And in that conversation, she entered the narrow gate. By trusting and following Jesus, she got baptized at the ripe young age of 90 years old. And when I met her, she was in her mid-90s. But she had that glow of enthusiasm that you see in new believers. The spark. It was written all over her. That's why I ended up asking her about the story. So Jesus' challenge, I think, is the same as in the words of Paul to the Corinthians. Examine yourselves to see whether or not you are in the faith. Test yourselves. The real test is not in what we say, Lord, Lord, or in what we do. In what we know, but in what we actually do. And Jesus also says, you know, if you just looks like you're doing this stuff for me, but you don't know me, knowing me and doing what I say and do, following me. It is the person who not only hears Jesus' words, but puts them into practice that stands on solid ground. The real test, of course, comes when the storms of life hit. And Jesus knew they're going to hit. Especially when we come to the tidal wave of death and have to stare it in the face. I appreciate what Dr. Lloyd Martin Jones said. That's kind of a helpful guide for us. If ever, therefore, he said, you feel the Christian way of life is rather irksome, difficult, just remind yourselves of the destination to which it leads. Remind yourself of the destination. When you get up in the morning, say, I am on the narrow way. It's going to affect my life today, but it's the way that leads to life. In this famous poem, The Road Not Taken, Robert Frost writes of finding himself in a forest of trees on a glorious autumn afternoon. He was walking down a path and there's a fork in the road. Which direction should he go? And when he makes his choice and picks his direction, he says to himself, I shall be telling this with a sigh. Somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood. And I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. Which road are you on in life? In light of Jesus' words, what are you going to do with him in his sermon? He has set the choice before us, and he's called us to choose to enter the gate and the road that leads to life. Let us pray.